Isaiah 51. We're going to be in the second part of Isaiah 51 tonight. So, to be honest, this is a text that until this week, I really just was not just fired up to talk about. Because I've kind of seen Isaiah 51 and 52 as filler, just to be quite honest. You go from Isaiah 49 and 50 with these great promises of what the servant's going to do. So both Isaiah 49 and Isaiah 50 are filled with promises of what the servant will do. And let's just review those real quick. Back in Isaiah chapter 49, God the Father is speaking to the Son in verse 5. But now the Father says, "He formed me in the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob back, to have Israel gathered to him so that I will be honored in the sight of Adonai, my God, who has become my strength." I mean, it's just so amazing that Isaiah 49 is welcoming us into this inner Trinitarian dialogue between the Father and the Son, all the great things that God is going to do through the Son. In the same chapter 50. In chapter 50, you have, just for example, in verse 6, the Son clearly saying, "I offered my back to those who struck me, my cheeks to those who plucked out my beard. I did not hide my face from insult, spitting, for Adonai Elohim will be my help." So here in Isaiah 50, the same thing. You have this great servant song. And then, of course, you get to Isaiah 52 and 53, the final servant song. And so just in the flow of Isaiah, you have Isaiah 49 and 50 with servant imagery, which just is so powerful. Isaiah 52 to 53, servant imagery is so, so powerful. And then you got 50 and 51, or 51 rather. And it's like, okay, this has some cool stuff to say in it, but I'm really not sure what we're supposed to do with it. I think now I finally get it. So we're going to think through what I'm going to call an interlude. And this is a very important interlude. Kirby, musically, what is an interlude?
It's just a pause from the main theme.
Right. Okay. So, like, for example, in Beethoven's Fifth, Carrie, you'll have that bum, 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 bum. That's picked back up in the third and the fourth. But the second's kind of seen an interlude. You don't hear that that sound as much. There's an interlude there. What Isaiah 51 is doing is an important interlude. It's taking us from the promises of 50 into 52 and 53. And this is what it's really doing. It's asking us, okay, God has made all these great promises of the things he's going to do through the servant. Here is how you know it's going to happen. So let's notice Isaiah 51, verse 9. We've already read this last week, but I want to review it tonight. Mark, are you willing to do some reading for me tonight?
Yes.
Okay, so we read this last week, but let's just get a context, please. I don't care about which translation you read from. Isaiah 51, verse 9 through 11, please.
"Awake, awake, clothe yourself with strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over? The ransomed of the Lord will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away."
Very good. So this is the prophet calling on God. God, wake up. Wake up. We are still in captivity. We are being oppressed. Wake up and come to our aid. Wake up and come to our aid. God, you led us from Egypt. You hacked the sea monster. You parted the seas. Wake up. But then you have this renewed promise in verse 11. "Yes, I will make a way for you. The ransomed will return. They will come with singing to Zion, and on their heads will be everlasting joy. I mean, it's just so poetic. I love verse 11.
I just like that he gave God the credit. You know, I mean, he proclaimed his glory by letting him know. I know
yes.
You're the one.
Yes. I mean, this is what theologians call the central agency of God. Isaiah, I think, is the main New Testament inspiration for seeing this, that it's not going to be human achievement that's going to accomplish this great exodus again. It's going to be the divine agency of God.
And Isaiah knew that.
Exactly. Isaiah is continually focusing on the agency of God that's going to bring this about. And so then you get to verse 12. Okay. Now, Mike did an excellent job about outlining Isaiah 50 and 51 in our podcast discussion. He calls Isaiah 51, 12 through 16, a discourse on God's faithfulness. And I can't come up with anything better to call it myself. This is going to be a discourse on God's faithfulness that we're going to see come back here. So Mark, go ahead and read this whole section for me. Isaiah 51, 12 through 16, please.
I am he who comforts you. Who are you that you fear mortal men, the sons of men who are but grass? That you forget the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth, that you live in constant terror every day because of the wrath of the oppressor, who is bent on destruction. For where is the wrath of the oppressor? The cowering prisoners will soon be set free. They will not die in their dungeon, nor will they lack bread. For I am the Lord your God, who churns up the sea so that its waves roar. The Lord Almighty is his name. I have put my words in your mouth and covered you with the shadow of my hand. I have set the heavens in place. Who laid the foundations of the earth and who say to Zion, you are my people.
Beautiful, is it not? Absolutely beautiful section. Now, let's work through this line by line. Now this is clearly God speaking here. This is Yahweh speaking. Who is he speaking to? Who is he speaking to? God says, I am the one who comforts you. Why are you afraid of a man who must die, of a human being who will wither like grass? So who do y'all think he's talking to here? Yeah, I do too. I think he's talking to Israel here. This is God now addressing Israel. So the prophet addressed God in 9 through 11, and now God is addressing Israel. I am the one who comforts you. And remember, this is the whole call of Isaiah 40 through 55. Comfort and keep comforting my people, says your God. Isaiah 40, verse 1. I am the one who comforts you. And I love the question in verse 12. Why are you afraid of a man who must die, of a human being who will wither like grass? Gracious, I wish I remembered that more.
No kid.
I mean, how often in my life do I become afraid of
what someone thinks?
Yes, or could do. Yeah. Why am I afraid of what I think? And often this is just negative self-talk. Why am I so afraid about what someone could possibly say or do about me? I don't know if Ben is zooming. It's Ben zooming with us tonight. Let's see. Yeah, he is.
I am. Yep.
Yeah. So Ben, you shared the great theological fountain of TikTok with me recently. Is it TikTok or Instagram about self talk? Like, where do those a lot of those negative self talk? Where does that come from?
It's like if you back channel it far enough, it's your pride that's speaking, because your insecurities are the things that you are afraid of people seeing you in you the most. So it's really all about self at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, the talk that Ben shared with me, I thought was so insightful that I don't know about you all, but at least most of the times when I am self-talking in my head, it's not positive talk. Like, especially whenever I wake up in the middle of the night, I wish I woke up and remembered all the wonderful things I've ever done and all the wonderful things people have said to me. But for some reason, when I wake up in the middle of the night,
in the dark,
yeah, in the dark, I like my brain will just go to all of the horrid things that I have ever said and all the people I ever have potentially hurt. Sometimes it's just crazy stuff. Like some things that I can't even remember until 3 o'clock in the morning. I know I'm the only person that goes through this. No one has to testify. But I think that a lot of that is my insecurity. It's a fear. And I'm going to talk about this in my sermon Sunday morning. The opposite of faith is not unbelief. The opposite of faith is fear. What God is calling Israel to here is do not fear, but have faith. Have faith in me. Do not fear. Bruce, go ahead.
And you know, Ryan, just to finish that thought, you know, and it's a classic cliche that what you fear, you end up hating. And I think a lot of times that pride that turns into self-loathing does become a form of self-hatred in a way. We're so self-deprecating or so scared of getting things wrong and things we've done wrong because of that pride to the point that we, in a way, do sort of hate ourselves.
Yeah, well said. Yeah, well said. I mean, the talk within one's head can lead oneself downward very quick. Yes. Yes. Bruce, go ahead.
That's why we have to dilute it out with the word of God. But this whole conversation about self-talk has me thinking about one of my favorite quotes. And it goes like this. Don't believe everything you think.
Mic drop. Yeah. I like that. I like that. Don't believe everything you think. I like that. Because here's their problem, verse 13. You have forgotten Adonai, your maker. There's the problem. Daniel?
And you know, that kind of goes back to what Ben just said. If you go back to 44, verse 21, he says, well, Israel, you will not be forgotten by me.
Yes.
They themselves forgot about God. God has forgotten about them.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to, yes, it's a reversal. It's very well said. It's very well said here. And what you're noticing, that verse again, Daniel, was
44, 21.
Yeah, in 44, verse 21. I'll put this in the chat box.
Yeah, remember these things, O Jacob and Israel, for you are my servant. I have formed you, you are my servant. O Israel, you will not be forgotten by me.
Yes. Again, we have to trust in the faithfulness of God who won't forget his people.
Yes.
Right? That's what hope's all about. God won't forget. The memory of God is long. Yes. God will not forget. He's not forgotten about us. And we need to recall that. We need to recall that. You have forgotten Adonai, your maker. And here's why this matters, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundation of the earth. Instead, you are in constant fear all day long because of the oppressor's rage as he prepares to destroy. But where is the oppressor's rage? Now, before we go on, let's play psychologist for a moment. What is this text teaching us about fear and insecurity? Fear is no Christian virtue. What is this text teaching us?
But it's real.
It's very real. For us. It's very real, but it's not a virtue.
No.
And Ryan, by speaking through fear, and I think we equated that with pride. We don't you think that we are blocking the power of God through us?
Yes, well said, Mark. Well said. What else? How is this text teaching us to confront fear? Because, I mean, these are the fearful thoughts that inhabit our fallen heads. Nobody likes me. Nobody loves me. Nobody cares about me. Everybody hates me. Everybody thinks I'm horrible. Everybody's going to try to ruin me. Everybody's working against me. Those are the negative self-thoughts that so often fill people's head. Randy?
I think it may be calling us to put it in perspective, to look to God's power and say, where does this fear that I have or whom that I fear, how do they measure up to God? And then when we see it doesn't even come close to our almighty, powerful God, then that fear can subside and faith shines through.
Well said.
And it's so funny because Isaiah has already said that. He's already stated that about God. Wants you to one, wants you to one, wants you to one. And he says, yes, I am the one that comforts you. So why?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's something I got to look introspectively about myself.
And I think what both of y'all are saying here is it's calling to mind again the faithfulness of God, the commitment that God has to us. I mean, that ultimately has to be our faith that carries us forward here. It's not an empty magical ball that says, oh, everything will be all right. No, since like I said Sunday morning, we have to hope in God, not perhaps knowing that everything will be okay, but hoping in God. The oppressor may come. People are probably going to do some bad things. Hope in God. Daniel?
A couple times ago when Ben was in town, he mentioned this one time, but anytime you're like, you're lacking self-confidence or you're focusing on yourself, basically that's selfishness is what that is.
Yes, it is.
Rather than focusing on the faithfulness of God.
Yes.
You're inward thinking and thinking of your inadequacies, and basically that comes down to selfishness is what it is.
I pray this conversation, I'm not going to tell you on my sermon topic yet for Sunday morning. Eric's already read my sermon, but y'all are like reading paragraphs out of my sermon. So many of the negative doubts that plague our head, it's selfishness. It's selfishness, right? Yeah. And again, when I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, I don't for some reason start thinking about all the gracious things I need to be doing the rest of the day. It's that negative selfishness, and that's what we have to overcome. Let me get online first. I think I saw Mark, Heath, and then a couple of people in the Zoom room. Let me get Mark.
I'm trying to think really quickly, but I believe that we in recent lessons have talked about being free to do good works. So if we can drop this pride and this selfishness, we unchain ourselves, so to speak, to react in ways that we probably would never have believed we could before. And do things.
Well said. Well said. Going to that sermon that I'm preaching, Mark, that you're drawing from, the marketplace is a chaotic, scary, uncertain place. But we need to make sure that we're resting secure in the vineyard. Yes. Heath, I think, was just reaching forward to give a quote. And Heath, I'm going to give another quote from a very wise man. As a long life's road you row, focus on the donut and not the hole. We gave out some donut holes at the food pantry a couple weeks ago, and it gave me a chance to have long excursions. Go ahead.
That's the easy one to remember, though, isn't it?
It is.
It's with you. Yeah. Yeah, just living it. That's the hard part.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. All right, Jane, and then Eric. Go ahead, Jane.
And I think I've said this before. Isolation is the will of the adversary.
Yes.
When he isolates us and we feel shame, that's when we're at our lowest and our weakest.
Amen. Amen. And I think that started a couple weeks ago. I think it's so interesting that the five virgins were not alone. There were still four others. And we always need to, we need to rest assured in that. What is the song? There's nothing worse in this whole wide world. It's worse than being alone. Take my hand.
I stood in the night.
Thank you. Thank you. What song is that? Bruce, help me out.
Where no one stands alone.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Right. There is nothing worse in this whole wide world than worse than being alone.
Or to think that you're alone.
Yes. Yeah. Because that's what we need to realize, right?
You're alone. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're in the body of Christ, you're not alone. No, absolutely not. You're not alone.
But the adversary tells us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Go ahead, Eric.
Just the way that this whole chapter reads, it seems like it's talking about people who are in some way pursuing the servant or paying attention to the one who is going to send the servant. Just by the way, it talks about, you know, it's written to those who pursue righteousness. It's written to my people. It's written to those who know righteousness. It's written to those who, and it's written to these people in whose heart is God's law. And they start to question God, you know, where are you? Why is all this going on? You know, especially coming from people who God seems to be identifying as his people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're questioning God. Where are you? Why aren't you awake? Why aren't you redeeming? But thinking God kind of like it seems, turns the question in on them and says, like, where are you? Why are you away?
Yes.
Jerusalem.
Yes.
And he's the one that kind of brings up the whole fear concept.
Yes.
And I mean, I hope we kind of talk about tomorrow in our numbers class that, I mean, there are healthy things to fear, such as God.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what he's trying to get them to do is confront their fears through his faithfulness.
Yes.
Confront the things that you fear or even that you should fear through the faithfulness that God is awake and is ready to deliver.
Yes, yes. I listened to the talk that you both actually sent me individually today. It was that exact idea, right? It's training your eyes to look past the problem to the cure. And that's what God's wanting here. Don't focus on the captor. Focus on the freedom. Focus on the freedom. I'm going to skip verses 13 through 15 because I want to make sure we get to the second part of this section. Go down to verse 16. I'd never noticed this verse. Oh, it's so cool. The ESV does not translate this as well as the CJV. I have put my words in your mouth and covered you with the shadow of my hand in order to plant the skies, lay the foundations of the earth anew, and say to Zion, you are my people. Is that not amazing? Now, this does seem to be servant type imagery, that God has put his words in the mouth of the servant, that God has hidden the servant until it's time for him to be revealed. And through the servant, he has planted the skies and laid the foundations of the earth. This is the God who has made his promises. That whole idea of planting the skies, that's going to be, it's great. Go ahead, Daniel.
That's the call back to Moses, what that is. He covered with his hand, he put his words in his mouth. That's what it is.
Absolutely.
That's what it's all about.
Yes, sir, it is. Yes. We're going to see this more in chapter 52. But we've talked about there is David imagery that the servant draws from, clearly Psalm 23, things like that. But we're also going to see in chapter 52, Moses imagery comes so much stronger here. So it's a very, very, very astute observation, Daniel. All right, well, let's now talk about the cup. We can talk about 3 verse 16 the rest of our class, but I want to make sure we talk about the cup. Mark, read this whole section for me, 17 through the rest of the chapter, please.
Awake, awake, rise up, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, you who have drained to its dregs the goblet that makes men stagger. Of all the sons she bore, there was none to guide her. Of all the sons she reared, there was none to take her by the hand. These double calamities have come upon you. Who can comfort you? Ruin and destruction, famine and sword. Who can console you? Your sons have fainted. They lie at the head of every street like antelope caught in a net. They are filled with the wrath of the Lord and the rebuke of your God. Therefore, hear this, you afflicted one, made drunk, but not with wine. This is what your sovereign Lord says, your God, who defends his people. See, I have taken out of your hand the cup that made you stagger. From that cup, the goblet of my wrath, you will never drink again. I will put it into the hands of your tormentors, who said to you, fall prostrate, that we may walk over you. And you made your back like the ground, like a street to be walked over.
It is. So this was a discussion that I did not lead us down in our whole year and a half study of the atonement. But what is the cup of the Lord? Clearly, in the New Testament, Jesus prays, Father, let this cup pass from me. He tells his apostles, he tells James and John in chapter 20, the cup that I am to drink, you likewise will drink. This chapter 20, somewhere in 20 to 25. What is this cup? And then clearly, we on the first day of the week gather to partake of the cup of the Lord. I noticed a few things about this today that I think finally made some things come together for me, and I'd like to talk through this. Verse 17. Awake, awake. Stand up, Jerusalem. Now, let's talk through this. Jane, if he's calling the people to wake up, what's the assumed posture before this call?
Sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like they're asleep. I'm going to use another word here. It seems, say what?
They passed out. They're so intoxicated, they passed out.
Do y'all notice this? Now, this was the missing piece. Eric already got my missing piece that I've never noticed this, but it makes, I went back and I reread Ezekiel 23, Jeremiah 25 in this text. Those are the three main texts in the Old Testament about the cup of the Lord. Every single one of them has this imagery in it. You would not only tell someone to arise, arise, who is sleeping peacefully in their bed, but also someone who's just passed out flat on the floor. This is God shouting, wake up, wake up, get up, Jerusalem.
Because it says in 21, you who are drunk.
Now notice this, okay? I want you all to think through this. What does the cup of the Lord do? Now, my unbiblical thought before this was the cup of the Lord destroys. It's the cup of the wrath of God destroys. That's not what's going on here in this passage. And likewise, go back and read every passage in the Old Testament about cup. It's in every single one. I do not know how I missed this for so long. Go ahead, Daniel.
I was to a podcast and last year talking about every time the cup of wrath of the cup of the Lord is mentioned, it's always when they've been turned over to a Gentile nation.
Every single time.
Even the captivity.
Every single time they have been handed over. That's it. Every single time. That both of you know where I'm going here. But let's wade through the wine for a moment. Verse 17. At Adonai's hand, you drank the cup of his fury. You have drained the dregs, the goblet of drunkenness. I prefer the ESV's translation of this. It says, wake up. Wake up, stand up, O Jerusalem. You who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering. Now, get this imagery in your mind. Paul, I'm going to ask you this question. I want you to listen to the text and tell me the answer here. For those who have drunk from the cup, what effect does the cup have on them? You who have drunk from the hand of the Lord, the cup of his wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering. What effect does the cup have on them? Right. They're not thinking straight. If you look at this word staggering, it's only used three times in the Old Testament, but every single time it's this idea of like someone who's just drunk, right? You know, just staggering. This is the idea of someone who has lost their sobriety. Wait, and their... Say what?
It's like a way of folly.
Say what?
It's like the way of wisdom, not like walking the way of folly.
It is. This is woman folly. Woman folly in Proverbs 7 or 8. She invites any who want to come get drunk with her. This is going to be the effect of the cup of the Lord. So I want you all to notice this. Those that drink the cup of the Lord are not destroyed. They become drunk, unsober. What's the right adjective there?
Not thinking straight.
There you go. We'll use that. Say what?
Impaired.
Yeah, that's a perfect word. Yeah. Imperfect word. They're impaired.
Perfect
word. It's what I was looking for. Okay, they're impaired. So, now this is really important before we move on. Is everybody on the same page? Good?
Yeah.
Okay. The cup of the Lord makes them impaired. They're staggering. They're drunk. They're not thinking straight. So what does God tell them? Get up, wake up, arise. Verse 18. There is no one to guide her among all the sons she has borne. Not one of all the children she raised is taking her by the hand. Now, this is where God is likening Jerusalem here, in particular, Jerusalem to the mother of his children. Now, this image is used at other times in the Old Testament, but the idea here is that Jerusalem is the mother of God's children. And as the mother of God's children, gynocentric interruption, you have here this idea that all of the other children are unstable. There is no one to guide her. Among all the sons she has born, none of the children she raised is taking her by the hand. Why would none of Jerusalem's children be able to guide her? Why would none be able to walk with her, take her by the hand?
They're all drunken too.
Now, you, both of you said it, Randy.
They're all drunken too.
They're all impaired. Daniel?
Yeah, they're impaired themselves.
All of them are impaired, right? Every last one of them is impaired. They can't even take Jerusalem by the hand. Verse 19. These two disasters have overcome you. Yet who will grieve with you? Plunder and destruction, famine and sword. By whom can I comfort you? Now, we already know the Lord is the only one who can comfort. But amidst their situation, plunder and destruction, famine and sword. This is a war-torn area. Get the image in your mind here. This is a city, Jerusalem, that is war-torn by sword and famine and destruction and plunder. It's impaired. And in their impairment, who can they not call upon? See the picture? Verse 20. Your children lie helpless at every street corner. Like an antelope trapped in a net, they are full of Adonai's fury. They, the rebuke of your God. I'm going to read the ESV's translation. I prefer the ESV's here. Your sons have fainted. They lie at the head of every street. Like an antelope in a net, they are full of the wrath of the Lord, the rebuke of your God. Daniel, in that verse, all of the sons of Jerusalem, what's their posture?
They fainted.
From?
Drunkenness.
Drunkenness.
Yes.
They're passed out. Okay. This is a horrid scene. I mean, this is walking upon a city that is so impaired by their drunkenness. Now, I've tried to think of an analogy for this, but what does it mean to drink the Kool-Aid? Jane, what's the story of that?
And it goes back to Jonestown.
Which is? For those that don't know, we may have some non-U.S. citizens who don't know this. What is this?
It was a mass suicide murder in Guyana in the 70s.
Yeah.
Where the poison was administered through Kool-Aid.
Now, isn't that interesting? As I thought about this image, Jonestown is what came to my mind. This is a city. So Jonestown, as Jane said, mass suicide by Kool-Aid, killing their own children. It's horrific. This is the situation of Jerusalem. Literally, Jerusalem has drunk the Kool-Aid. Every last one of them has passed out. Every last one of them is impaired. Every last one of them has fainted in the streets because they have drunk from the cup of the Lord's wrath. Go ahead, Randy.
So just for clarity, so is this a drunkenness that they have taken on willingly, or is this the cup that has been administered to them? And then is it their choice to come out of it, or is it now God determining it is time for you to come out of it.
Fortunately, Isaiah answers this question for us. Go back to Isaiah 29. This is the question we need to ask. And this is the question I've been simmering on for literally 2.5 years. And I've not had a good biblical basis to answer this.
I think I know, but I think it's...
But I think Isaiah 29 is going to answer your question very definitively. Read for me, Randy, Isaiah 29, verses 9 and 10.
Astonish yourselves and be astonished. Blind yourselves and be blind. Be drunk, but not with wine. Staggered, but not with strong drink. For the Lord has poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and has closed your eyes, the prophets, and has closed your heads, the seers.
Now, let's think through the imagery here. Did God give the people stupidity? Was that God's desire for his people? No! Did God desire for his people to be blind? No! Did God desire for his people to be drunk? No, the ESV, I think, actually translates this a bit better. I'm sorry, you ready? CJB. The CJB translates this a bit better. It says, if you make yourself stupid. I think this is a reflexive verb in Hebrew, meaning it's like you do the action to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you make yourself stupid, you will stay stupid. If you blind yourselves, you will stay blind. If I may say it, if you get yourselves drunk, you'll get even drunker. So you'll notice then, this is the answer, right?
Right.
The drunkenness in their situation of the cup is God saying, you want to be blind?
You wanted it. Here it is.
Here's more blindness. You want to be deaf? Here's more deafness.
But now,
go ahead.
But now he's calling them out of that, saying, okay, your time of suffering with that.
That's it.
You've done your penance.
That's it.
So to speak, and then let's go forward from here.
That's it. Okay. And that's where you're seeing God. God is not desiring the people to fall further into the drunkenness. God actually wants the people to wake up to sobriety. That's going to be the desire of God. Daniel?
I was going to say, that's exactly what I was saying. In 29, verse 10, he says, he poured over you a spirit of deep sleep. And then verse 9 of chapter 51, he tells them, awake, awake, and focus on God. You forgot him. Focus on him now.
This is the answer to chapter 29. Exactly. Yeah. I knew we wouldn't have time to do it. But if you go through, I'm going to put these in the chat box. Go ahead, Randy.
Soberness sometimes is talked about as single-mindedness. If you think it's spiritual soberness, you're always focused on God as your faith base.
Yes.
And so if we think about that, then being impaired and not sober-minded, they've fallen to these idols and they've used them as their faith base. And so God has just let them be overcome with that, right?
Yes.
So let them get taken on by Babylon. And so you wanted that. Okay, here's this nation that is filled with idols, filled with all kinds of immorality, burning children to gods and so forth. And so in the midst of that, how low are you going to fall?
That's it.
In that impaired condition?
That's it.
And now sober up. Get your focus back on me and come out of that. Is that?
I think 100%. Okay. I think 100% that's what's going on here. And I'll just say before I get to Kirby, for those of y'all that want to dig deeper into this, go through these chapters after class. Isaiah 29, Jeremiah 25, Ezekiel 23, that should be Lamentations 2 and 5. But so much of the language in this chapter comes from those chapters. And every single one of these says the same thing. And I'll also put on here Psalm 60 is also very helpful. Go ahead, Kirby.
Well, I was just going to say, it's not an element, but the exile that they experience, that's what he's talking about here.
And yes.
Now, you know, that it's never going to happen again. You'll never drink it again. I'm going to take you out of that.
Right. And this is where he's describing exile as drunkenness. Now, I want us to think through this for a second, y'all. Why is exile described as a situation of drunkenness?
That's kind of what Randy said.
I think it's you desire to take your eye off of God. So go where you can almost not see God. I mean, you're going to be so overpowered with other things.
Yes.
And in the pit of despair, I mean, that's where you're in the darkness is where we struggle to see the light.
100%.
So I think that's what it means, right?
I agree 100%. And I think it's so interesting as you go through Isaiah, you have promises like this: I will guide them to springs of water. Mm-hmm. As you go to the land, that was Isaiah 49, verse 10. There's so many other passages like this, that in the land, you will be sustained by bread that never runs out and by water. But in captivity, get drunk with it. Get drunk with it. Stagger away. Fall on and look impaired. That's what it's going to look like. Now, let me work through the rest of the text. Therefore, verse 21, please hear this in your affliction, you who are drunk but not with wine. This is what your Lord Adonai says, your God who defends his people. Hear, I have removed from your hand the cup of drunkenness, the goblet of my fury. You will never drink it again. This is God saying, yes, you wanted it. I handed you over to it. You wanted it. I handed you over to it. And this is what it looked like. Your mother was a disgrace. And every last one of you were passed out impaired from your drunkenness. That's what it looks like. But I'm not going to do that to you again. Now, the solution's not going to come until chapter 53. But someone is going to take the cup away. I will instead put it in the hand of your tormentors, who said to you, bend down so we can trample on you. Now, I read verse 23 as a rape scene. If you look at the word that is used here, I'm not going to go in great detail with it, but I think this is a horrific rape scene. And you flattened your back on the ground, like a street for them to walk on. What's God going to do?
Cyrus is good. Persia is going to give it to Babylon.
Yes.
Babylon is going to drink it.
Exactly.
Jerusalem now is Babylon.
Exactly.
Hand it over to Persia.
Now, this is where we have to work matters forward a little bit. This is where we have to work matters forward a little bit. Daniel's leading us in the right direction here. God is going to take the cup of drunkenness from his people and give it to Babylon. God is going to take the cup of drunkenness from his people and give it to Babylon.
Judging them of that.
Exactly. As you look at the book of Revelation, the final judgment that you see in Revelation 18 is the judgment of Babylon. Babylon will be judged. This cup of wrath comes back in Revelation 16 through 18. And there, the one who finally is given the cup of the Lord's wrath is Babylon. And in the book of Revelation, Babylon is the mother of all that is evil. Mm. Babylon is essentially the harlot of the adversary. What then is Isaiah 51 working us through? Eric, go ahead before we get to the answer. Go ahead.
My question did you connect this to the Passover in Exodus? Because it says it twice, and it just like stood out to me.
Please.
Bow down, did we make Passover? You made your back, and you have made your back like the ground. It reminds me like a belly, the serpent who's being forced to crawl on his belly. But also, then it said, in like the street for them to pass over, just like the double mention of Passover. Not quite. It sounded to me like the curse of the serpent or the evil one in Genesis 3. I just don't know if there's any kind of connection to Passover or the serpent there. Did you say anything else?
That's a phenomenal question, and I don't know. Okay. I'm gonna have to go do some digging.
It's like their own Passover through the shedding of blood.
What you're saying makes a great deal of sense, Eric. I need to look at the language and see what the language is going on there. But I think the story definitely fits. Even if the wording doesn't fit, the story fits. Yes. So let's then work this forward theologically. Why then does Jesus pray, let this cup pass from me? Let this cup pass from me.
To be given from the center of him, from him, give it to battle eventually.
I think that's what's going on there.
Yeah.
I really do.
Your will be done, that's his will.
Now, 100%. If you remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. I did a sermon on this a year ago, last January. If you look at that word there for weak, it's the same Greek word for sick. As you look at Jesus in the garden, it's like he has entered fully into the sickness of human flesh.
Captivity.
He has gone right into the very heart of captivity. He doesn't want this cup to stay with him. He wants this cup to be handed over to another. So what's he going to do? He's going to exhaust all of the forces of evil that are put upon him and not give back wrath, but give back mercy and love. And finally, the cup that has made drunk the nations will be passed from Israel and handed over to Babylon. This is why Revelation ends with, just listen, I'm not going to tell you where this is. Well, Hank, you need to know. This is Revelation 18, verses 1 to 3. Just listen, though, please. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. He called with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a great dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of their luxurious king." Finally, what happens to Babylon? Babylon has the cup of God's wrath poured upon her, and she is finally handed over to her drunkenness. And I think that is the ultimate judgment of God. Handing them over to their drunkenness. That's what Revelation 18 is all about. I have like three of you. Let me get Eric and Randy.
I mean, you just hit on something. And so the cup of wrath is God saying, if you don't want to focus on me, have this, just be full of this non-focus.
Yeah.
Just be full of whatever you want to put in my place. Be full of the pain, the suffering,
yes,
the unrest, the unhappiness. Have it all.
Yes.
Just have it all.
Yeah.
Your desire.
Yeah.
Your desires are going to take you right to that place where, yes, you're unhappy, you're unrestful.
Yes.
That's what Jesus said in the garden, not my desire, but your desire.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, Randy, this is the point here. My misreading of this in the past has been assuming that the cup of God's wrath was meant for destruction. It's not meant for destruction. It's meant for drunkenness.
And you
choose it. Go ahead.
And even maybe not totally destruction. In my mind, it was meant to cause some kind of suffering.
Yeah.
Right. That is partial destruction, but it was a method that God was going to use to bring a suffering about.
Yes.
And I think we steered that in the wrong direction.
Yes. This text, just when you see that theme between cup and drunkenness in every single Old Testament occurrence of it, it's undeniable. Eric, go ahead.
It just strikes me that, I mean, not just in terms of alcohol, but like anything that you are consuming and becoming more and more tolerant of, and losing your awareness of how you're responding to it. You can never get enough to fulfill your desire until, yes, it kills you, you know?
Yes.
But with God, if you approach him kind of in the same way where you're always trying to be filled more and more full of his spirit and his love and his grace, then, you know, it does the inverse of it. It just gives you
more life.
Yeah, more life.
Well said. Hank, I'm going to be reading from 1 Peter here in a second if you want to be turning there. But let me get Bruce first.
I may open up a can of worms. I missed the connection with the garden. And so I want to ask the question this way. I know that Jesus prayed, Father, let this cup pass from me. Mm-hmm. If it's your will, if you want me to drink it, I will. Mm-hmm. So what's go back over how that connects to what Jesus was talking about. He said, I'd rather you let this cup pass from me, but I'll drink it if you want me to.
Is it a temporary taking on of this?
I do.
This cup? Yes. I think that that's what came to my mind, Bruce, is that it might, he was willing to take on the temporary suffering, knowing it would eventually pass on to the great Babylon of evil. But also in that, he could show us how to deal with that as well. Like Ryan said, through his willingness to suffer that through love and mercy, not dealing out his wrath on those that brought it to him, that's how we need to deal with the world, with evil that comes our way.
Yeah, and I would say the same thing, just a different way, that in Isaiah 51, yeah, God temporarily handed his people over to the cup. Well, he handed the cup temporarily over to the people.
All those concepts, exile, depravity.
Yes.
He drank that so that we don't have to.
Exactly. Jesus Christ has exhausted the cup so that no longer do his people have to have this cup. It's now passed on to Babylon.
Yeah.
Babylon now has the cup. Go ahead, David.
Promises that you'll never drink from it again.
Never again. Never again. It's going to be the work of the servant. Bruce, did that help your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
It was a really good question. Well, y'all, this has been a great class. I don't think this is just filler anymore. I think this is a very important interlude to get us ready for what the servant's about to do in chapters 52 and 53. I do want to close with a reading from 1 Peter.
But that's typically what interludes do, right? Set up the next section.
Oh, yes. Because we're about to go into that dark third section. All right. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 1. Since therefore Christ suffered, and Randy, I'll be ready for you after this. 1 Peter 4, verse 1. Since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. So as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the desire of God. For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, lawless idolatry. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery that they must align you. But they will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is why the gospel is preached even to the dead, that though judged in the flesh the same way we are, they may live in the spirit the way God does. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. Mm-hmm.